Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. We humans seem to have experienced the hottest day ever recorded on Earth, the day before Independence Day. The average global temperature exceeded 17 degrees Celsius, 62.6 degrees Fahrenheit, over the entire planet's surface, which beats last year's record buster of 16.92 Celsius, 62.46 Fahrenheit, reached in August 2016 and last July. We can only hope for another ice age soon. And now, by James Banks, former principal of Star of the Sea Catholic School in Astoria, the beginning of black baseball. Starts with a quote. Baseball is a legitimate profession. It should be taken seriously by the colored player. An honest effort of his great ability will open the avenue in hand with the opposite race in the greatest of all American games, baseball. And that was a quote from Saul White, History of Colored Baseball, 1906. Saul White lived to see his dream come true when Jackie Robinson played his first game for the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947. But from 1899 until Robinson's time, a gentleman's agreement among the white masters of baseball banned blacks from the major and minor leagues. Only white men such as Ty Cobb, Rogers Hornsby, and Lefty Grove reaped the rewards of being national baseball heroes. Some of the most gifted athletes who ever stepped on a diamond played behind this white curtain, both before and after 1899. Others, only journeyman ballplayers, just tried to survive and earn a living in a land governed by Jim Crow. These courageous men pioneered the way for Jackie Robinson and for the great black teams, among them the Pittsburgh Crawfords. Some of these pioneers integrated America's game before the door closed tight in 1899. Ironically, John Bud Fowler hailed from Cooperstown, New York, the legendary home of Abner Doubleday's first baseball game. In 1872, just 7 years after the close of the Civil War, and only 3 years after the Cincinnati Red Stockings established themselves as the first professional club, Fowler joined the white team in Newcastle, Pennsylvania, becoming the first professional black player. Primarily a second baseman, he barnstormed across America for the next 25 years, and in 1887, he hit .350 and stole 30 bases for the Binghamton, New York club. Moses Fleetwood Walker, the next black player of significance, combined intellectual ability with athletic prowess. In 1878, at the age of 21, he entered Oberlin College in Ohio. During his final year at Oberlin in 1881, he became the catcher on the newly formed varsity baseball team. Oberlin played 3 games and won them all, including a victory over the University of Michigan. Walker left Oberlin at the end of the year without earning a degree and enrolled at Michigan. He won varsity baseball letters there in 1882 and 1883. After 1 season at Michigan, Walker left and returned to Ohio, where he joined the Toledo Baseball Club of the Northwestern League. Toledo won the pennant with Walker catching 60 games and posting a .251 batting average. The next season, he became the first black major leaguer when Toledo joined the 2-year-old American Association, recognized as a major league along with the much older National League. Fleet Walker's career lasted through 7 seasons of almost continuous racial abuse. Frank Grant, perhaps the best of the black players before the turn of the 20th century, began his career in 1886 with the Meriden, Connecticut team of the Eastern League. He hit 325 at Meriden, but later in the season he moved to the Buffalo Bisons in the International League and blistered the ball at a 340 clip. In 1887, Grant left Buffalo to a second-place finish with a 366 average and led the league with 27 doubles, 10 triples, and 11 home runs. He also stole 40 bases. Grant forged another outstanding season in 1888 with a 326 average, 19 doubles, 6 triples, 11 home runs, and 26 steals. Instead of furthering his career, however, success worked against him by calling attention to his collar. The other Bison players refused to let him sit for the official team photograph, while opposition pitchers consistently threw at him, and base runners coming into second base made serious and often successful efforts to spike him. Buffalo failed to offer Grant a contract for the 1889 season, and he signed with the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania team of the Eastern League, where he played for 3 years. From 1892 until the end of his career after the 1903 season, Grant never again played for a white team. Southpaw George Stovey, the first black pitcher, began his career in 1886 with Jersey City of the Eastern League, and in 1887 with Newark of the International League, he posted a brilliant mark of 33 wins to 14 losses. During his magnificent season, Stovey became one of the central figures in an incident that led to the eventual exclusion of black players from organized white baseball. On July 19th of that year, Newark had scheduled an exhibition game against the National League's Chicago White Stockings, managed by Constantine Cap Hansen, baseball's first real superstar. Stovey, being the ace of Newark's staff, drew the starting assignment against Chicago, but on the day of the game, he begged off because of illness. Newark won the game anyway, but the circumstances of Stovey's absence emerged as a racial confrontation. Rather than being sick, Stovey had backed out because the popular and powerful Anson had refused to put his team on the field against a black man. Anson's action set the precedent that led to the banishment of blacks from white baseball by 1899. So, Saul White, a middle infielder of exceptional ability, often hit in the high 300s and had a brilliant career before the turn of the century. But White's greatest contribution lay in keeping alive the dream of integrated baseball. In 1902, Walter Schlichter, sports editor of the White Philadelphia Item, decided to put together a new black team. He called his team the Philadelphia Giants and hired Saul White to be his manager. White immediately recruited Frank Grant, along with third baseman Bill Monroe, and outfielder Andrew Japp, quotes, Payne, to form the nucleus of the team. A number of black teams had emerged by this time, most notably the powerful Cuban Giants, but this group was special. They rolled to an 84-43 record and claimed the Eastern Black Championship. Schlichter and White even decided to challenge the Philadelphia Athletics, champions of the American League, to a short exhibition series. The Athletics had enough to win both games, 8-3 and 13-9, but manager White slammed 3 hits in the second contest. In 1906, White penned his poignant tribute to the courageous black pioneers, history of colored baseball. At the same time, he continued his struggle to keep the Giants going in the face of severe financial problems. The team folded in 1911, but Saul White remained one of the most respected men in black baseball until his death in 1948, just 1 year after the game became integrated once more. Another astute baseball man also dreamed of integrating baseball, John McGraw, a fierce competitor who in 1901 managed the Baltimore Orioles of the new American League. That March, during spring training in Hot Springs, Arkansas, McGraw became quite interested in the play of some bellboys at the Eastland Hotel. One of them, Charles Grant, had played second base for the Black Columbia Giants of Chicago in 1901. McGraw decided the young man had enough ability to play in the major leagues, but how could he overcome the color barrier? McGraw's inspiration came from a map where he noticed Tokahoma Creek. He named Grant Chief Tokahoma and said he was a Cherokee Indian. Predictably, the disguise failed, and Grant never played a regular season game for Baltimore. Even as Saul White's Philadelphia Giants suffered their demise, New York City began to emerge as the heart of Eastern black baseball. From Harlem came the Lincoln Giants, formerly of Lincoln, Nebraska, one of the best teams in baseball history, black or white. The Lincolns were, like the Pittsburgh Crawfords, also a great black team, loaded with talent. Smokey Joe Williams and Cannonball Dick Redding headed the pitching staff and were complemented by catcher Louis Santop, shortstop John Henry Lloyd, and center fielder Spotswood Bowles. Lloyd's plaque rests in the Cooperstown Baseball Hall of Fame. The others should be there, too. Texan Joe Williams joined the Lincoln Giants in 1912 and spent 12 seasons with them. At 6'5", he often intimidated batters, buggy whipping his fastball and cracking his curve with a big overhand motion. Williams joined the Giants at age 26, the very prime of his career, and dominated all opposition. His victims included an impressive array of Major League white teams during exhibition play. During 1912, for example, he shut out the New York Giants twice, 2-0 and 6-0. He also whitewashed the New York Highlanders at 6-0. Williams really warmed up in 1913. Although losing to an all-star contingent 1-0, he fanned 13 batters. He later beat the same group 7-3 with 14 strikeouts. He then went up against the Philadelphia Phillies and their ace right-hander, Grover Cleveland Alexander. Alexander, with 373 career victories, ranks as one of the greatest pitchers in history. On this day, however, Williams bested him 9-2. Smokey Joe also beat another future resident of Cooperstown, Chief Bender, 2-1. By 1914, Williams beat the Phillies 10-4 and then hooked up in a monumental duel with Rube Marquand of the New York Giants, another future Hall of Famer. The game ended in a 1-1 tie, as each man allowed just 3 hits. Marquand whiffed 14 and Williams 12. Big Joe had a bad year against major leaguers in 1915, winning 1 and losing 2. He didn't pitch against any big league teams in 1916, but 1917 was a different story. Williams began with a 10-inning no-hitter and 20 strikeouts against the New York Giants, champions of the National League. Unfortunately, he lost 1-0. Smokey Joe also beat Bender again, 11-1, and outpitched the great Walter Johnson, 1-0. Williams won 3 games against big leaguers in 1918, including another victory over Marquand. And on opening day in 1919, he pitched what he called the greatest game of his life. This time, the competition was black, and the opposing pitcher was his old teammate on the Lincoln Giants, Cannonball Dick Redding. Williams won it, 1-0, pitching another no-hitter. Redding allowed only 2 hits. From 1912 to 1914, Williams teamed with Dick Redding to give the Lincoln Giants one of the best pitching combinations in baseball history. Another big man at 6 feet 4 inches, Redding earned his nickname of Cannonball because of the enormous velocity of his fastball. He was frightening on the mound, turning his back to the hitter during his windup, much in the same fashion as Satchel Paige did with his famous hesitation pitch. Dick also showed little reluctance in buzzing any man who dug in too aggressively or tried to take away the plate. Redding's career began in 1910 with Saul White's Philadelphia Giants. During spring training in 1911, he pitched batting practice for the New York Giants and made a big impression on manager John McGraw with his speed. After failing with Charles Grant, McGraw encouraged Redding to move to New York, hoping he might be the one to break the color barrier. Once in New York, Dick joined the Lincoln Giants and won 17 straight games, including several no-hitters. Redding had another excellent year in 1912, but in 1913 he shifted into high gear. He won 43 and only lost 12, including a perfect game against Jersey City of the Eastern League. In another game, he fanned 24, and in yet another, he pitched 6 innings, striking 15 of the 18 batters who braved his cannonball. Over the years, Redding pitched very well against big league competition, but only a few of his performances have been preserved. In 1918, however, he went up against Carl Mays, the submarine pitcher of the Boston Red Sox, who would kill shortstop Ray Chapman of the Cleveland Indians the following season by hitting him in the head with a pitch. Redding lost a 14-inning confrontation with Mays 2-1. He also lost in 1918 to Big Jeff Tesoro of the New York Giants, again by a score of 2-1. In addition to the pitching brilliance of Williams and Redding, the Lincoln Giants also had plenty of offensive firepower. Their fleet leadoff man, Spotswood Poles, played a splendid center field and swung the bat with authority. In 1911, for example, he hit .440 with 41 stolen bases. Poles found easy picking against the big league pitchers, hitting .610 against them between 1913 and 1917. Like Cool Papa Bell many years later, he was compared to Ty Cobb. The Lincoln Giants catcher, Louis Santop, hit from the left side with enormous power. He sometimes called his shot, as Babe Ruth possibly did in the third game of the 1932 World Series. On October 12, 1920, when the two great sluggers played against each other, Ruth went hitless, while Santop went 3-for-4. Santop played with the Lincoln Giants during their real glory years, hitting .470 in 1911, .422 in 1912, and .455 in 1914. The battery of Santop at 6 feet 4 inches, combined with either Joe Williams or Dick Redding, might well rank as the most physically intimidating combination in baseball history. Even among all these great stars, shortstop John Henry Lloyd stood as the heart and soul of the Lincoln Giants. Lloyd was called the Black Wagner, a comparison to Honus Wagner of the Pittsburgh Pirates, who is considered the best shortstop ever and perhaps the best player ever. When told of the comparison, Wagner said, "I am honored to have John Lloyd called the Black Wagner. It is an honor to be compared with him." Once during an interview, Babe Ruth was asked who he thought was the greatest player of all time. "You mean in the major leagues?" replied Ruth. "No, the greatest player anywhere," came the response. "Then," said Ruth, "I'd pick John Henry Lloyd." In 1911, Lloyd joined the Lincoln Giants, who were managed for the first half of the season by Saul White. When White left, Lloyd, the team captain, became manager. Under his leadership, the team rolled to victory after victory over both black and white opposition. One of their best years was 1913, with 101 victories and only 6 defeats. Besides leadership, Lloyd provided superb defense and a big bat. He hit 475 in 1911 and 375 in 1912. And in the Lincoln Giants' 1913 victory over the Philadelphia Phillies, he ripped Grover Cleveland Alexander for 2 hits and also stole 4 bases. Lloyd's greatest success against major leaguers came in Cuba during the winter when he played for the Havana Reds. In 1909, the Reds played an 11-game series against the Detroit Tigers and won 7. Eustaquio Pedrosa even pitched a 10-inning no-hitter against the American leaguers. Lloyd hit .546 for the season against big league pitching, including several hits off of Addie Joss and Mordecai Three Finger Brown, both future Hall of Famers. In 1909, Detroit Tiger slugger Ty Cobb had missed the trip to Cuba. He went for revenge in 1910. The Georgia Peach, as he was called, hit well as the Tigers won 4 of the 5 games he played. Cobb, with sharpened spikes glistening, also wanted to show the black upstarts how he ran the bases. Lloyd prepared for his attack by wearing cast iron shin guards under his baseball stockings. Poor Tyrus never really had a chance. Besides John Henry's surprise, Cobb faced the rifle arm of black catcher Bruce Petway. He tried to steal twice and was thrown out both times. On his third try, he was out by such a wide margin that he just turned around and ran off the field, snarling and cursing. Cobb vowed to never play against blacks again, and he never did. Lloyd hit .500 for the series. He was followed by another American black, Grant Home Run Johnson, who hit .412, and by Petway, who hit .388. Cobb finished fourth at .369, and his teammate Sam Crawford posted a .360 average. Connie Mack's Philadelphia Athletics, fresh from trouncing the Chicago Cubs in the World Series, followed the Tigers into Havana. The Reds swept 3 games as Lloyd hit .300 against Chief Bender and Gettysburg Eddie Plank, 2 more Hall of Fame hurlers. John Henry Lloyd's Lincoln Giants were by no means the only great team during the early years of black baseball. Saul White's Philadelphia Giants must be considered, as well as C.I. Taylor's Indianapolis ABCs. In Chicago, the Leland Giants, later the Chicago American Giants, became a powerhouse under the direction of a genius named Rube Foster, who in time would be called the father of black baseball. And that was James Banks, the beginning of black baseball. He was principal of Star of the Seas Catholic School in Astoria in the early 1990s. He wrote many articles and short stories about baseball and a television script about the life of black baseball player James Cool Papa Bell for the USA Network. He also worked on a book of boxing stories by Jack London and another on astronomy. He also wrote a biweekly sports column for the Daily Astorian. The beginning of black baseball is taken from a chapter of Banks' book, The Pittsburgh Crawfords, The Lives and Times of Black Baseball's Most Exciting Team. The chapter was reprinted in the August 1991 North Coast Times Eagle. And now, something I wrote. Smiling Man. The man was smiling. It was the 4th of July. Somewhere else, small children were parading in patriotic costumes under American flags. The man's face was proud, and his smile was gentle. "Look, he must be Thomas Jefferson," people pointed at a small boy with a powdered wig askew, who laughed shyly at their attention. "And that must be George Washington," That little girl just has to be Betsy Ross. Perhaps his smile was sad. The crowd laughed at another boy who was Abraham Lincoln trying to keep his whiskers from falling. Mothers and fathers affectionately waved to their children parading by. His friends were not smiling. Great brass bands followed the marching children, crescendoing the air with stirring American songs, the sun shining molten gold on trumpets and bassoons. The smiling man and his friends did not move. Behind the bands came the veterans, marching to the drums, wearing blue American Legion or VFW caps, some of them with empty sleeves pinned to their shoulders, others stumped by on artificial legs. There were four of them, counting the smiling man, and they lay on the wet ground of a coconut grove. In the afternoon, after the picnic lunch, some of the men and boys played baseball on the local park diamond, while politicians swore their undying patriotism to the crowd sitting on the grass. They threw out such catchwords as liberty and freedom for all, as if they were baseballs. Above his sad smile and wide-open eyes, the smiling man's head was neatly cut away, the round lower half almost resembling a child's cereal bowl. His friends laying on the moldy ground had parts of their bodies missing also. A veteran without an arm, who did not wear an American Legion or VFW cap, attempted to shout down the politicians, calling them liars and murderers. He remembered the smiling man and his friends, would in fact never forget them, although in the course of almost a year at war, he had seen thousands of dead, most of them farmers and their families, whose bodies were strewn like rubbish around their burned homes or out in their rice fields. The loss of his arm seemed almost a justifiable penance, but he was more often bitter about it. He remembered walking over to the bodies in the coconut grove. He had killed them the night before. He had seen them by the light of a flare trying to set up a machine gun and blew them apart with a hand grenade. It had rained the rest of the night, and in the morning the bodies lay leached of blood. The smiling man stared at him with dead eyes. He was transfixed by the smile, the neatly cutaway head resembling one of those cornflakes bowls with a comic face his mother had given him when he was a boy. A friend shook him out of it, and he walked away into the months ahead until the war took his arm. Police took his arm and led him away, warning him to not disturb the festivities again or they would lock him up. The smiling man and his friends were left to rot in the grove. The sun set behind tall mountains, and night crept over the bodies. Somewhere else, great colored starbursts flared in the sky, showering the thrilled crowds with streamers of flaming oranges, reds, and yellows. One magnificent burst formed the stars and stripes for a few seconds, and everyone applauded. Elsewhere on this night, heavy jet bombers shot into a tropical sky and turned toward a jungled coconut grove. This is Michael McCusker. A quote from the great American cartoonist Art Crumb about its great American writer. As Mark Twain once said about America, it is a civilization which has destroyed the repose of life, replaced its contentments, its poetry, its soft romantic dreams and visions with the money fever, sordid ideals, vulgar ambitions, and the sleep that does not refresh, quote unquote, of a quote. Yet, Abraham Lincoln said that if the people retain their virtue and vigilance, no political administration, quote, by any extreme of wickedness or folly, unquote, can very seriously injure the governmental concepts of our founding ancestors. And James Madison argued in 1791, when he introduced the Bill of Rights to the Constitution as its first 10 amendments, that the people, not the government, possess the absolute sovereignty.